Good afternoon. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. You know, it's Pinktober, the month set aside every year for us to talk about, think about, walk for, run for, do all kinds of things for breast cancer awareness and fundraising. But despite years of this kind of work, about 41,760 women in the U.S. are expected to die in 2019 from breast cancer. And many women and men feel ignored during Pinktober campaigns. Also, the upbeat nature of Pinktober, focusing wonderfully, of course, on inspiring stories of survivors, can also perpetuate myths that everyone survives breast cancer, that breast cancer has become simply a hiccup in life. And obviously, for many people, that's not how any of this has worked. So we are going to spend the next hour talking about breast cancer and separate some fact from fiction. We're joined in the studio today, we will be, by Dr. Richard Crownover. He's a radiation oncologist at the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and also Sandy Stanford, who is a breast cancer survivor and a board member for the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation. And you can give us a call with your questions, comments, and stories at 210-614-8980. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with Sandy. How are you doing, Sandy?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your breast cancer story.
I was diagnosed in December, towards the end of December of 1993. I was 50 years old, and then in January I started treatment. And say 25 years, it'll be 26 years soon. And I was very lucky because it was caught by mammogram. And it was the first year that mammograms were free from insurance because of a federal law. So I did, and that's how mine was discovered. Although when I was 45, my doctor thought she felt a lump, and I had a mammogram and it showed nothing, but where she felt is exactly where the tumor was.
Oh, wow.
So mammogram doesn't always pick up everything, but it's the best thing we've got right now.
Right now. And we'll talk about that later. There are some people who are pushing for better technologies,
yes,
because everyone believes that mammogram is
right.
Fine, and it's
right.
Not exactly fine. So we'll talk about that in a bit. Did you start your work as sort of an activist in this community at that point?
Not until a year after my treatment,
mm-hmm,
because you sort of try and get your life back to normal, which is never normal again. You find a new normal and go on with your life. Different people do different things. I found mine in volunteering with the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation and doing outreach programs, education programs, whatever they needed me to do. So that's how I got involved, and then I got really involved when I learned more of the science. I hated science in high school and college.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, once I got that diagnosis, I learned a lot. And so now I'm what's considered a research advocate. So I do a lot more into the science of breast cancer rather than telling people to go get their mammogram. Because as long as there's been Breast Cancer Awareness Month, if they don't know it by now.
Right, absolutely.
They should.
So Dr. Richard Crownover has joined us in the studio, radiation oncologist at the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, MD Anderson Cancer Center. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with that. She mentioned that her cancer was detected with a mammogram, which I'm a woman in my 40s. It's, you know, you hear mammogram. But it doesn't detect all cancers, does it?
Well, mammograms are an excellent screening tool. But that's correct. It doesn't pick up all cancers, and so that's why we supplement it with physical exams as well. A common example of this, there are two types of breast cancer, infiltrating ductal carcinoma, that's about 80%, the vast majority, and those tumors form what feels like a piece of gravel in the breast. It just feels like a rock. So they're very obvious to anybody who runs across them with their fingers or something. And that could be a woman doing a self-breast exam. It could be a partner is a common way for that to be found, or it could be a physician doing an exam. But there's 20% of breast cancer is a type called infiltrating lobular carcinoma, and then there are a few zebras or very rare things. But the infiltrating lobular carcinomas, one of our senior physicians, Dr. Cruz, who's in his mid-80s now, always likes to say they're sneaky.
Right.
And they're very hard to feel on physical exam. They feel more just like a diffuse thickening, and they really don't show up on the pictures very well either. So those are the ones that we tend to find a little more advanced because they're just so hard to find early. But really, physical exam, which should be emphasized, physical exam and mammograms for screening are complementary, and both should be done.
So I read a story earlier today that suggested that MRIs are a good way to detect these sort of difficult-to-detect cancers.
So MRIs aren't recommended as routine screening for most women. And there are a few situations where they would be. If there was a disconnect between what we were finding pathologically on a biopsy and what we were seeing on routine imaging, which would be a mammogram and an ultrasonic examination, ultrasound, if there was a discordance, a disagreement, then we would use an MRI to try and get a clearer picture. In terms of screening, it's really used for very high-risk women, typically that are premenopausal, so the very young women that, because of family history, need to have screening. And that's because mammograms don't work well in that population. Mammograms work well in women who are a bit older, and they work great in postmenopausal women because the active glandular tissue that's driven by the high levels of estrogen in premenopausal women makes a very complicated picture to try and pick things out of, whereas an MRI can see the structure better in that age group. But in the women who are getting close to menopause and postmenopausal, then the pictures are very clear because the glandular tissue goes away and you're looking for something in kind of a pristine, clean environment.
So as a woman in her 40s, there's been a lot of confusion over the last 10 years or so about when you should start mammogram, or should you even do self-exams? Are they worth your time? Just not really knowing at all what the right thing to do is. So for women in their 40s, doctor, what should we do?
So routine self-breast exam used to be very strongly emphasized, and now it really isn't. In fact, I think it's been dropped from the recommendations by the American Cancer Society, for instance. So people should be generally aware of their bodies, but the compulsive looking routinely really isn't encouraged at this point. One of the reasons is if you look too often, you'll never find anything. It's kind of like watching a child grow, and if you look at them every day, they always look like they did the day before, right? But if you look at them in a picture 2 months apart, you can see that something happened in between. So the self-breast exam on a monthly schedule really isn't emphasized anymore.
And when should you start your mammograms?
And the mammograms, that's very controversial. It depends on which society's recommendations you're following.
Yeah.
And so pretty much everybody will agree that at 50, they should be started, but some higher risk women or some societies would recommend as early as 40.
All right, and it also depends on what your insurance will pay for. So we'll get to that straight ahead, but we're going to take a little break here. We want to hear from you. Have you or a loved one gone through breast cancer diagnosis and treatment? What has been your experience with this disease? What do you want other people to know? Your story could help someone else. You can be anonymous too. Give us a call at 210-614-8980. You're listening to The Source on TPR. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies, and we're talking today about breast cancer, myths, facts, fiction, and Pinktober. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Richard Crownover. He's a radiation oncologist with UT Health San Antonio, and Sandy Stanford, who is a board member for the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation and also a breast cancer survivor. So you're the one I'm going to talk to you about thinking pink. I was really surprised, actually, a couple of years ago to learn that not everyone who's survived or who is currently fighting breast cancer is crazy about this whole Pinktober thing and everything associated with it. So Why is that?
I think it's because people think just because they buy something pink or you go to a store and it says part of the proceeds will go to breast cancer research or whatever, you don't know who that is. And so why should we donate or buy that particular product because we don't know where the extra money is going or how much of that money is going? Also, there have been instances where different places, different people, not in San Antonio, fortunately, but where some of the oil field rigs are painted pink in honor of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So it's like, do we really want to do this? So the majority of breast cancer advocates do not like Pink October because we think that it's too commercialized, mm-hmm. is the main thing. If you do want to donate, either donate to an organization you know or one in your community, or make sure that if you do buy something that's pink or says it's going to breast cancer research or to an organization, that that's exactly where it's going and you know what organization or research area it's going to.
So I think one of the other reasons that some people who are in the breast cancer community may not be crazy about it is they don't feel like it's totally inclusive. And I suppose if you're a man with breast cancer, you might absolutely feel sort of left out of Pinktober. And I thought it was interesting that a couple of weeks ago, Matthew Knowles, who's Beyonce's father, came out and said that he has breast cancer, trying to raise awareness about this because, yes, far fewer men get breast cancer than women, but it's deadly for them. Often, Dr. Richard Crownover, tell me a little bit about breast cancer in men.
Well, it is much rarer than it is in women. In the United States, lifetime risk for a woman is around 1 in 8. So it's very, very common, and almost everybody has a family member that has breast cancer. For men, it runs around 1 in 1,000. It's a much less common thing. And so that means that men that have breast cancer very often kind of have a sense of stigma because other people don't quite understand. They think it's men shouldn't get that, but men have breasts too. Mm-hmm. We just have a lot less breast tissue and we don't have the same hormonal drives in our body, so it's much less common.
So is it a different cancer or is it the same cancer that women get?
It's the same cancer. Yeah. It just develops in a man's breast instead of a woman's breast.
So how many men are diagnosed with breast cancer in a given year in the United States?
Oh, the total number, I don't know off the top of my head, but
right.
it would be small.
But some statistics I read suggest that it is more deadly in men than women.
We treat it the same way. So stage for stage, I wouldn't expect it to be more deadly. But it may be something that's found not as early because people aren't watching for it.
Right, stage for stage, not watching for it, not knowing what to look for, mm-hmm. and then perhaps being embarrassed to go get treatment for the pink cancer. What would a man look for?
Well, the same things that a woman would look for, which would be a lump or a bump in the breast area. What's interesting is men don't commonly think of themselves as having breasts, right? So they're more likely to think, oh, this is an injury to the muscle in the chest. But a lump or a bump, pain is not a common association with breast cancer. Only about 10% of breast cancers are associated with pain. So it's mostly just a lump.
I think that's an important message to get out too, because a lot of people think if you have something that could kill you, it's going to hurt you. And that's not true with a lot of conditions. But in this case, if you have a lump and it's not painful, that is not the moment to go, oh, it's not painful, so I'm fine. It's just no big deal.
Another key feature to throw in there is an enlarging lump. So something that persists, it's growing. You know, we all have lumps and bumps that come and go, but if it stays in that area and it's growing, see someone.
And there isn't, we don't have messages and taglines and slogans to remind men what to do to see their doctor about possibilities of breast cancer. So you don't have the at 50 get a mammogram. So is it just look out for a lump?
That would be the most important thing.
Yeah, and family history.
Family history. That brings us to genetics. And so a lot of people are getting at home, including me, at home, you know, 23andMe screening tests, and then going, phew, I don't have family risk, genetic risk for breast cancer. And that's not true, is it? I mean, you can't get your 23andMe and find out you don't have a variant on the BRCA gene and go, okay, I'm not going to get breast cancer.
No, you can't. It's not for that purpose.
It's not for that purpose. And I think a lot of people don't know that. So what are regular people to make of this wash of genetic information that's sort of washing over them right now?
Well, so Sandy's initial point was a good one, in that it's the family history. So put this in the context of, are there other family members who've had breast cancer? And this is primarily going to be the women in the family, typically. But the things we look for as genetic flags would be bilateral breast cancer, so family members that have breast cancer on both sides, family members that have breast cancer at young ages, or other associated types of cancers. For instance, ovarian cancer is probably the strongest association, and there also are some others that are less associated, but a strong family history of cancers in general, particular ones that are happening in young people.
So if you have had, if you're listening right now, a loved one go through, or you've gone through breast cancer diagnosis and treatment, give us a call. We'd love to hear your experience with the disease. What do you want other people to know? Give us a call. You can be anonymous at 210-614-8980. Sandy, did you have a family history of breast cancer?
Yes, but I do not have the BRCA mutation. I was tested. My grandmother on my mother's side, five of my aunts all passed from breast cancer, and two of my cousins. But so we have one of the other genetic mutations that are out there that are associated with breast cancer, and they're finding new genetic mutations every day almost because of all the new elaborate, fancy, wonderful equipment that's out there now that wasn't out there when I was diagnosed 25 years ago.
So we know that if you test positive for a gene variant on the BRCA gene, you may be at greater risk, but we also know that we don't know a ton. But you do know, in many cases, perhaps most cases, what your mom may have died of, what your grandma may have died of, what your aunts may have died of. And that would be something to talk to your doctor about, right?
And there's something to know about the testing is that it is evolving. It is getting better, and it's looking for some of the more subtle new things. So that means that genetic testing a number of years ago might be triggered again if there is a new diagnosis of in the cancer in the family that raises questions, just because we'd be looking for the things that are now being tested for that maybe weren't 5-6 years ago.
So we have a question here. If there is a family history and you know you have a family history of breast cancer, what do you do with that? What preventative measures can you take to maybe decrease your chances of getting the disease, doctor?
Well, some of the associations, we know that weight is a concern, and that probably has to do with increasing the amount of estrogen in the body, because adipocytes or fat cells create estrogen. Not at the high levels that the ovaries do, but it is another driver. We know there are some associations with excessive alcohol, for instance. And so those are things. So most of the things that would fall under the rubric of a healthy lifestyle would be recommended for reducing the risk of breast cancer as well. And then the other thing has to do with knowing the family history. And it comes back to this question you were asking earlier about when to start screening and how to do screening. And so it comes down to this individual conversation with the physician about the risks and benefits at starting at a given age. And so some people should start their screening quite young, maybe as early as 30, 35. And if they're in a high enough risk population, for instance, a family that carries one of the high-risk genes, then perhaps those women need to have MRI screening so you get better pictures at a younger age when the glandular tissue is very active.
That's great advice. Our phone number here, at the source at Texas Public Radio is 210-614-8980, and we are going to the phones now. Jane is on the line. You were recently diagnosed with breast cancer, and your sister also recently diagnosed. I'm sure you have a ton of questions, Jane. What would you like to ask our experts?
Yes, I was recently diagnosed with breast cancer. What sent me to the doctor was that I had mastitis, and I noticed that my nipple had retracted. And at first, I kind of blew it off for a while, and after a few weeks, I did finally go to the doctor. I was sent in for a mammogram, and I was diagnosed at that time with stage one breast cancer. And at the same time, I found out that my sister was also diagnosed with the same thing. We both had our genetic testing done, and we both found out that we carry the CHK2 variant. I believe it is not really recognized within the research community, as far as it's not widely recognized like the BRCA gene. It is also, I found out, very common in the Hispanic community. So I don't know what sort of research is being done within the Hispanic community to find out more information about the CHK2 variant.
That's a great question, Jane. Does anybody, can you speak to breast cancer in the Latino community or the Hispanic community, and what kind of research is being done, Dr. Crownover?
Well, what I can tell you, I can't address directly the CHK2 variant, but for the Hispanic community, one of the things that's kind of unique about San Antonio is that our patient population has such a large Latina population. And so a lot of the prognostic nomograms, the things that we do to estimate the risk of disease that might lead to the earlier screening, those types of behaviors, the information to base that on for this population really doesn't exist yet. And that's because the models that were built didn't have adequate samples from a variety of different pieces of the population. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that there's an active interest in here, in building that information so it can go back into the models, and then we can address some of these more specific issues.
For you as, Sandy, as an advocate and activist in this community, do you think that it's doing a good enough job to sort of put its arms around all types of people who struggle with breast cancer?
I think so. I know that at the Mays Cancer Center, they do have a special populations department, and that's one of the things that they're addressing right now, are the number of Hispanics in not only San Antonio but South Texas that are developing breast cancer. And so I know that's being looked at, and there'll probably be more coming out. There's a conference in February just for Latinas about the science of cancer in Latinas. So hopefully more will be known by that time.
All right. We have much more to talk about breast cancer during this Pinktober after the break. This is The Source, and we are going to take this break to talk about Texas Public Radio's ongoing pledge drive. We're going to hand it over to your regular host right now, David Martin Davies.
Hi, this is David Martin Davies, and my apologies for not being here to host The Source today, but I have a good excuse. I'm in New York to accept a National Edward R. Murrow Award. The recognition is for a radio documentary that I reported and produced about human trafficking. In the documentary, I was able to show how this is happening all around us in the San Antonio area. I went out with a rescue operation with Roy Moss Youth Alternatives, talking to homeless youth in downtown San Antonio.
So here's one girl's bag.
Thank you.
One girl's bag. And then we get a couple of guys' bags.
I'm sorry.
The group is bundled up, so it's hard to discern how old they are, but there are signs that these are kids.
So you want the frozen bag? There you go.
One of the girls wanted the backpack decorated with the characters from the animated film Frozen. Also, I showed how a local group was reaching out to trafficked women online, offering them a lifeline.
If you need help, we are here for you. Thank you. Please take care of yourself, and may God bless you.
With that, one more voicemail is left, and Cindy goes back to her laptop to look up the next ad in the online sex marketplace.
New to town and looking to have naughty fun. Ask me about my sexy brunette friend, Rachel. Book us now before it's too late. We're just passing through XOXO.
It's like in this ad particular, we can tell that is a minor. That is not someone who's 20 years old.
And I told the story of a local woman who was forced into human sexual slavery and how she was fortunate to be able to escape.
And when I got in my car outside, I don't know what told me to lock the doors, but I did. I locked the doors, and there he was right there at my car. And he was showing me this picture in the phone of my daughter getting off the school bus. And he told me that if I didn't stop and do what he said, that he was going to take her and do the same thing to her. So I basically went back.
One question that people ask me about this reporting that I do is, how do I produce radio documentaries like this one? And still, here I am most days on the air hosting The Source. And the answer is, bluntly, is I'm putting in a lot of hours. All of that reporting and writing and editing for the documentary, that was done on weekends and late at night, even some extra early hours in the morning. It was a year-long reporting project that did take a toll on me, but I'm fortunate that it did work out and I'm being nationally recognized for that work. And I'm fortunate that I have the support of listeners like you. Because you decided that this work is important, I'm going to keep heading out into the dark corners and exposing what's going on. That's weekends, nights, early dawn hours together, you and me. We're going to be telling the stories that otherwise wouldn't be told. And for some reason you didn't support public radio, then who's going to do it? It's got to be you. I need your help. I can't do it without you calling in right now. I promise that I won't stop, but you've got to make the call and keep public radio strong. That number is 1-800-622-8977, and thanks.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies. And I'd like to remind you again to support Texas Public Radio today. Call 800-622-8977. Pledge Drive volunteers are happily standing by to help. They'd love to talk to you. You can also donate online if you are an introvert like me and prefer talking to the internet. Go to tpr.org. That's tpr.org. And we are now going to get back to our main topic here on The Source, which is breast cancer. And I'm going to go straight to the phones. We have John joining us. His wife is a survivor of breast cancer. John, you have Dr. Richard Crown over here from Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Sandy Stanford, who is also a survivor and a board member for the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation. What would you like to know, John?
Hi, yes. I just wanted to make a comment about my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer twice. And the second time she was diagnosed, she was very fearful of the outcome. And she chose not to know what the outcome was. So she left the room, and the doctor spoke with me and had diagnosed her at stage 4, metastasized, and had given her 2 to 4 years to live. Well, I'd like to say that I thought it took great courage to do that, and even more importantly, when I found out the information and she didn't know, it was a huge roller coaster ride for me, very intense. And it's something I'm grateful that she didn't go through. And I honestly believe that had she known what I knew, the outcome would have been worse. She's actually surpassed the 5 years they've somewhat said she's, they say she's now no longer has cancer, but she has to be on treatment for the rest of her life.
So, so I think that's pretty typical of people with metastatic breast cancer, and everyone who dies of breast cancer dies of metastatic breast cancer. And I know for partners, it's probably an incredibly difficult journey. And so I'm going to ask Sandy, what do partners of someone struggling with, in particular metastatic, but any kind of breast cancer, do they have support groups here in San Antonio for family members who are struggling and fighting this with everything they have? How do people help fight? Are there support groups for them or for survivors?
There are support groups for both. The American Cancer Society had one. I don't know if they still do or not. St. Matthew's Catholic Church has one. There's one downtown at the Robert B. Greene that's in Spanish. So there are quite a few actually around town. There's one that started over 30 years ago at the Mays Cancer Center called Keep Abreast. And they have a group for metastatic patients and another group for early breast cancer patients.
How do you find this kind of support?
You can go online. You can look at the American Cancer Society website for San Antonio. You can call the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation's helpline. We have a list of all the different support groups in town and where they're located. I know there's also one at SAMC. I still call it BAMC. Mm-hmm. SAMC. So I know there's still one there. So they're all around San Antonio. A lot of churches have them. So it could be all cancers together. There's some that are like the one at Keep Abreast, which is just for breast cancer. And the spouses or partners are more than welcome to attend that also.
All right. So this is how you call to share your experience or ask your question. It is 210-614-8980. You can also tweet us at TPR Source. And we just got an email from Georgie who wants to know how, and I'm going to direct this at you, Dr. Crownover, how do you feel about digital thermography as opposed to mammograms?
Well, it isn't an established way of screening or following breast cancer. There are a number of things that are being studied, and I would leave it still in that realm. Particularly what I would encourage is that a modality like that not be done instead of routine screening and imaging.
But in addition to?
Well, in addition to I have a lot of patients that will pursue things that I would say don't have a proven benefit yet. Mm-hmm. And I try and stay agnostic about them with these two caveats. One is, well, make sure that your doctors know what you're doing, okay? The other caveats are that make sure that you're not selling your house or selling your car to pursue something that has no proven benefit, because I've seen people do that mm-hmm. too often. And the other is, you know, don't do that instead of what we know works.
Right.
In other words, you still want best standard of care, not off on a tangent.
So we talked a little off the air about something that may be exciting for the future, but is not ready for prime time quite yet. But there's a lot of news. Every healthcare journalist in America, including me this month, is all vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. Where are we, Dr. Crownover, on breast cancer vaccines?
Well, it's something that's being actively researched, and Sandy was pointing out there are a number of places that are doing this. The Mayo Clinic's probably getting the most in the terms of headlines about that, but even they're suggesting that will be ready for prime time in about 10 years.
So 10 years, that's exciting, and
it is.
It's exciting for me, it's exciting for my daughter, but right now, what does breast cancer treatment look like?
Well, right now, we still have three primary modalities, which are surgery and then drug therapies, chemotherapy and endocrine therapies, and radiation. I would probably add that there's a fourth group that's very important, and that's the plastic surgeons are getting involved in procedures much more, so the cosmetic outcomes are improving. And then it would you'd have to be complete by including radiology, the diagnostic piece of this, and then the pathologists are giving us a lot more information to make our decisions on than they were. But primarily for early stage breast cancer, the most common course would still be surgery, and then if needed, chemotherapy, and then radiation afterward, and then possibly endocrine therapy long term, meaning over years. And then sometimes we're moving the chemotherapy up front for certain subsets of tumors and doing that before the surgery. For locally advanced tumors or for metastatic disease, we typically are starting with the drug therapies first. And then we think about what needs to be done for local treatments, surgery and radiation. One of the areas that's changing with metastatic disease is there's this concept of oligometastatic disease, where somebody has distant disease but just a few spots. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we're treating those very intensively with surgery and or radiation. And some of those patients we're expecting will be very long-term survivors, even with metastatic disease.
So is treatment now in 2019 much improved from treatment when Sandy would have gotten it back in 1993?
Much improved. So in 1993, I would have been a resident at that time.
Right.
And what I can tell you is that the evolution of treatments, I'm using radiation as an example because that's what I'm most familiar with. We now are much better at protecting the heart, so we don't expect to be seeing the late cardiac events that we had seen with older treatments. The acute effects of radiation, we don't see the significant skin burns with the loss of a lot of skin. At the beginning of my career, cobalt machines were still in use, and we saw a lot of that. Now we use higher energy machines that are skin sparing, so we can actually give a higher dose inside the body where the tumor is than we are to the skin. So it's a much more comfortable process for patients. The amount of lymphedema that we're seeing now is dramatically reduced. That went down from about a third of patients having significant lymphedema to where now it's closer to 5%, maybe 1 in 20, and primarily only the locally advanced tumors. We're seeing a lot less in the way of nerve injuries, and also our treatment times are getting much shorter. Now we can do the same work, for instance, with 3 weeks of radiation that would have taken us 5 or 6 before.
All right, so that is really interesting stuff, and we'll go more into detail about all of that after the break. But we also have a bunch of callers who want to talk to you all, so we will be doing that as well. You are listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
And you are listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies, and we are talking about breast cancer today. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Richard Crownover. He's a radiation oncologist at the Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Sandy Stanford, a board member for the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation, and a survivor of breast cancer herself. Can you tell me a bit about what the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation is?
We were started in 1990, I believe, is when Dale Eastman started the organization. And that was because there was nothing in San Antonio outside of Keep Abreast. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted to do something other than go to a support group and hear sad stories. She wanted to go out into the community, let people know about breast cancer, educate about breast cancer. So that's how she started the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation with 4 other ladies. And so we've grown and grown and do a lot in the community. We do outreach programs, provide free mammograms and patient assistance. And we do... I have it written down in my notes, and I
That's quite all right. If it comes to you, you can tell me. But I would love to go to the phones right now and talk to another survivor. Kathy joins us now. Hi, Kathy. What's on your mind?
Oh, good afternoon. It's nice to be on. Yes, I'm a 15-year breast cancer survivor, and I was a patient in San Antonio. I live in Fredericksburg now. And I'm so glad that Sandy is on the radio, because I do agree with her that although I love the concept of Pink October, but come November 1st, I'm still a breast cancer survivor. And I was a pharmaceutical rep for 25 years and sold breast cancer medications before I was diagnosed. And I think that women need to take control of their lives, get early mammograms. Early detection is the best source of a successful breast cancer treatment. And that we as women have got to ask the questions, have got to be in control of our medical health and go to people like Alamo, to the groups that Sandy works with, to get support and help and be healthy women.
All right. Couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. Kathy, let's go to Elaine now, also a survivor. Screening question. Elaine,
yes.
What's on your mind?
Yes. Thank you so much for hearing me. And it's so nice to have a doctor there. He's esteemed. But just a long story short here, of course, I have a history of 10-year remission of lobular. I had some lymph node involvement, radiation, chemo, and I'm fine now. But I was wondering, no family history, what kind of screening is best? I've heard, you know, the digital, the 3D, you know, with the dense breast tissue and lobular history.
Hit it, Dr. Crownover.
Well, the digital mammography is superior to the analog type that was done for so many years. And now we have the computer-assisted reading, and that helps them get through larger numbers of cases and kind of flags things for the radiologist. But again, it comes back to a particular person's situation, the age when they're having the screening imaging done. Is it follow-up for a history of breast cancer, or is it totally just screening in somebody who's never had breast cancer? So there is no one-size-fits-all, I guess is what I'm saying. But
and something we talked about off the air is, since there is no one-size-fits-all, it requires a good relationship with your doctor and a lot of open communication. A lot of people are intimidated by their doctors. How do you work through that?
Let's see.
You know, I'm afraid. Sometimes I'm afraid to ask questions, and I'm a medical reporter.
Why are you afraid to ask questions?
I feel like they're stupid questions, right?
No question
I know,
is stupid.
Right? I know that, but it's still scary. It's that white coat syndrome.
You know, it's interesting that, so I treat breast cancer. That's been a big part of my practice through my entire career. And at the beginning of my career, people were saying, but it's breast cancer. Shouldn't it be a woman who's the doctor that's treating breast cancer? I've treated thousands of women with breast cancer. I still can count on two fingers the number of women that have said, I actually want a woman instead of you. And so that's always kind of been reassuring to me, that it isn't too intimidating.
For me, it's not gender. Mm-hmm. It's just the white coat, y'all.
I don't wear a white coat in the clinic, but that's because the other thing I treat is peds, so I don't want to scare the small children.
Of course,
children.
It's a metaphorical white coat.
Yeah.
You're the guy with all the degrees, and people are intimidated by that. But doctors are people, too, and they want you to be healthy. I think that's the bottom line.
And I think it is reassuring. The way I approach patients is, and I sometimes will just explicitly tell them this, is when I'm giving a recommendation, I feel that it has to be the same recommendation that I would give to a family member, or I'm not practicing medicine correctly. Right. And I do have a couple of family members who've had breast cancer, and I've gone through appointments with them and met with their doctors, so I've sat on the other side of this. I have some sense of it, and I can say that it's been battle-tested, that what I'm recommending is the same thing I said to them.
All right, we're almost out of time here, but real quick, I want to talk about health insurance. We talked about how a lot of times the kinds of testing and treatment you can get hinges on what kind of health insurance you have. Do either of you want to speak to that at all?
I can't talk about health insurance itself, but I can tell you that in San Antonio, we're very lucky because we have like our group and a couple of other groups who will do patient assistance and provide free mammograms. There is another group that if you have no insurance or you're underinsured that or have no insurance whatsoever, that they will help find you treatment for free or for a very low cost, and another group that will help provide your aftercare once you've finished your treatment. So we're very lucky in San Antonio.
With the controversy around mammograms, and some insurances, I'm guessing, will not pay before 50, does that, does what the doctor thinks or says impact health insurance, yes or no, we've got to go? Is that a clear question?
I think what you're saying is if we had a patient who was under 50, can the doctor trump the health insurance
plan? Yes, it
is. And we can twist their arms to a big extent, but we can't ultimately make the decision. But
all
I think
right.
We can encourage them to go ahead.
Fantastic. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.